Now, there's a lot of, you know, technical concepts and things like that, like patterning and pattern recognition, zonation, sector analysis, all these different terms. I don't know how easy it's going to be to explain to people like me, not very clever. What does this mean? What is it that you're doing? Why is this different from normal agricultural practice, and either in one's backyard or you know, on a larger farm or on an industrial farm?
Well, I'd say one of the key principles in permaculture is about mutually beneficial relationships. So when we're designing a system, we're looking at how everything in the system relates to everything else. And I think traditionally we haven't been doing that in traditional agriculture. We sort of separate things. So in permaculture, we're looking at how the waste product of one system can be the resource and the food for the next.
So give us an example, for example, either in kind of the backyard garden or in the more kind of industrial agricultural application.
For instance, in the backyard garden in San Francisco and the whole Bay Area, we have a surplus, and we're always trying to deal with surpluses in permaculture of slugs and snails. So, you know, instead of saying I've got a slug problem or a slug disaster going on, we look at that as a resource. So you've got this slow-moving meat moving through your backyard. So we want to find a use for that resource ecologically. So one of the things we often say in permaculture is we don't have a slug surplus, we have a duck shortage. So if you bring a duck into the system, you're now converting all that. I mean, you might want to eat the snail. Some people do, you know. But you might prefer to eat duck eggs instead. So you're converting one form of energy to another and not looking at it as a problem. And then, of course, the duck generates many of its own yields. You know, you can get feathers from it. If you're not a vegetarian, you can eat meat. You get entertainment from a duck, you know. So all these things are taking a problem, like surplus of slugs or snails, and turning it into multiple yields. And that's, you know, part of our attitude in permaculture is the problem is the solution. So you asked about the difference, say, between organic agriculture and permaculture. So I can give you a couple of really good examples from there. I was doing a show like this once where someone called in and said, I've got 5 acres of star thistle and I want to raise some cattle on that land. How do I get rid of the star thistle, you know, ecologically? And I nearly took the bait and answered the question, which would have been the organic answer is, well, there's these cool bugs you can release and it'll kill the, you know, except that that's not the permaculture answer. The permaculture answer is, you're so lucky. The guy said, what are you talking about? Star thistle is spiny stuff. It's horrible. And I said, basically, what you need to think about is the star thistle is a resource. So how can you do something with that? And being that the problem is the solution, we say, wow, here's a resource, star thistle. Your problem is you chose the wrong livestock. What you really need are bees, because bees will produce star thistle honey, which is worth 5 times clover honey and way more than the meat you would have produced on the land. So in permaculture, it's us looking at the system and then responding the way nature is offering it to us rather than forcing a pattern onto nature that it doesn't want.
And I understand that another sort of key concept, aside from the multiple use, you know, concept, is that in a permaculture system, there are also multiple sort of support systems for any given element of that system. Kat, could you explain a little bit about that concept?
Yes, the concept is that we want to plan redundancy. So we want to design systems that serve a particular function and have many elements that will serve that, as well as we want to have each element to serve many functions. So it works either way.
And again, illustrating it by...
Well, for instance, if it was an energy system, let's say you're trying to provide energy for a few houses. You might use a cogenerator, which is a car engine that, instead of having a radiator, produces hot water for use for heating all the homes. But now that you've got the hot water tank, that system can be supported by solar panels that will also create hot water. Or you could have some kind of biomass heating, you know, boiler to also provide hot water. So 3 different production systems would support the one element of hot water for the settlement.
So if one thing goes wrong, then you can still have hot water.
Well, nature never relies on one thing, because that's a straight way to extinction. So, you know, having multiple ways that something's supported, even in our human systems, makes a lot of sense.
Another fun example recently I heard is a woman who's making crackers out of, and she didn't have enough room to bake these crackers or to dehydrate them. So she recognized that her automobile was very hot at a certain time. So she started to use her automobile as a way to, as a dehydrator. So we can get really creative about different uses for
using the surplus heat from the automobile, you know, excess to the needs of the user to do another job.
I think that was
and
a
famous. Could be scented with fumes. Fumes.
That's a classic way that the Boy Scouts actually make their first meal on the way up to the mountains. But
cook it in the car.
Actually, permaculture steals from anything that works from anybody's system. So if the Boy Scouts did it and it works, we'll steal from there too.
Excellent.
Well, let's talk about sort of urban environments because Kat, you're with Urban Permaculture Guild in Oakland. When we're talking about urban, are we talking about backyards? Are we talking about like pots in somebody's windsill? I mean, how can people apply permaculture in, let's say, in a high-rise building? Is that possible? Or do you really need a small garden? What can you do?
Yes. That's all possible. And there's so many scales that we can work on in permaculture. But in an urban environment, We start with ourselves. You mentioned the concept of zonation. So the first step in an urban environment is to look at yourselves and see how are you integrating the ecological design principles in your own self. And then you go out to zone one, which is your home, and then right outside your home, and then it goes on from there. So in the urban environment, there are lots of examples of container gardening, rooftop gardening. We have green roofs in some of our natural buildings. There's also organizations that are doing a lot of work around urban permaculture that are community groups. Actually, there's one, a conversion of a Navy base that is doing a lot of permaculture work right now in the city of Alameda.
You know, in other parts of the world, like in the Middle East, you know, rooftop gardens are essential not only for providing food, but providing insulation from the sun. You know, multiple functions, again, having a rooftop garden. You know, even on the bigger scale in urban areas in New York City, you'll find now some skyscrapers are incorporating what we often do on the small scale in cold climates, where they have in the multiple stories basement below the building, in the winter, they freeze an enormous block of ice using, you know, the surplus cold air. And then all summer, they use heat exchangers to exchange that coldness, you know, to cool the building instead of using air conditioners. So, you know, a lot of energy efficient things that would fall within permaculture really work within cities. I grew up in San Francisco, and my family and I used our next door neighbor's property as well as our own, and we grew 80% of everything we needed, and we had plenty to give away. So, you know, it's a fallacy to think that farming is only efficient far away from the city and has to be shipped in. Most of the food that people eat in the world are grown in cities or nearby. And in fact, in New York City, prior to 1850, all food that people ate in New York City came from no farther than 7 miles from the border of the city.
This is Michelle Chan Fischel with my co-host Pratap Chatterjee, and you tune to Terra Verde, a weekly environmental radio show on KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley and KFCF in Fresno. You're listening to Dave Bloom of the International Institute of Ecological Agriculture and Kat Steele of the Urban Permaculture Guild. Well, getting more into this idea of kind of examples of permaculture sort of in our midst, so to speak. I mean, if you lived right here in the San Francisco East Bay, I mean, where could you see examples of permaculture practices and principles actually, you know, just in front of your own eyes?
We are so fortunate to live in this area because we have a surplus of that happening here. We have a whole network of community gardens all throughout the Bay Area. We also have incredible support for school gardens. So we have the Edible Schoolyard. We have the Malcolm X Schoolyard. We have programs that are doing incredible things with youth, like the Bay Area Youth Alternatives Garden. We have the People's Grocery, which is a mobile market that sells organic vegetables in West Oakland. Those are some of the examples I can think of.
There's a community garden whose name I can't quite remember. It's on Martin Luther King, about 3 blocks north of Ashby, that one of my students designed years ago, and it's a very sustainable permaculture design in that community garden. Anybody should visit that. It's across the street from the tennis courts there.
Hmm. Now, what if you didn't have land at all? And I sort of brought that up, and I was wondering if maybe you could come back. If you have no land, so you're living in a skyscraper.
But there's gobs of land everywhere, so that's the principle of cooperation. So If you don't have land, there's so many people who have surplus land that they don't know what to do with. And a simple ad in the paper will bring you a dozen offers to come garden with somebody on their land. So, you know, shortage of land is not the issue. There is so much urban land available, but you need to make the human connections to go ahead and take the shortage you may have and use the surplus of someone else's to work out.
So people want people to come work on their land and will share their produce.
Well, let's see. Now, you come to my house and you garden at my place and I get free vegetables and I don't do anything. I think you'd have someone taking you up on that offer, you know.
Yeah. One of the greatest resources we have in an urban environment are human beings. So finding ways, as Dave mentioned, to connect with each other and really evaluate what our needs are and what the resources are, and we can share that information. So invisible technologies like the internet and groups of people coming together and sharing their information is also a permacultural design practice. It doesn't always necessarily have to mean working with the land, even though we're taking all of our inspiration and our examples from the land.
Right. And so, I mean, when you talk about permaculture concepts in legal systems or in organizing systems or in cultural systems, I mean, give some real examples of how you see that happening.
Well, I think the most important thing about permaculture is, you know, quite frankly, in the way we fight capitalism. What we're doing in this process is we're not going up against capitalism where it's strong. What we're doing is providing structures and opportunities to make capitalism irrelevant. So the idea being that if we stop giving the capitalists our capital, that's our most effective tool. That means supporting each other and cooperating. So if I provide a surplus of food and I can go ahead and, you know, trade that for a surplus of time someone else has, and they can trade that for a surplus of some other goods, we're going outside of the capitalist system. You know, one of the things we always teach in permaculture classes are structures such as alternative currencies, et cetera, which help us create our own universe next door to capitalism that, you know, will work. And see, that's the thing. Capitalism depends on eternal growth. You don't have to completely crash capitalism to get it to stop. You just got to slow it down. A good example is the Arthur Andersen Corporation, that when they started getting bad PR because of the Enron thing, what collapsed that corporation was all the employees realizing there was no further growth, no more promise, no more, you know, so the slowing down of Arthur Andersen, the employees scattered to the four directions and the corporation collapsed. So, you know, in this way, permaculture hopes to bleed off by 100 mosquito bites enough capital, you know, by our taking care of ourselves that, you know, we can collapse some of the things that are causing problems.
Yes, one of the most wonderful things about permaculture community and design to me is the empowerment that it gives and offers all of the community. So we recognize that we can use this process of assessing our needs and visioning what we want and finding concepts that work and then putting them all together in this holistic plan, that we can apply that to all these different areas, and that in itself is a consciousness raising and a way for us to grow as a community.
So what are some of the examples of, are there people sort of like writing books and teaching courses, and where do you learn about permaculture in the Bay Area? I know there's a course down in Santa Cruz where people go down and spend 6 months learning about permaculture there, and other things that are closer that people can find out very quickly.
Yes, we have a surplus and abundance of ways to get informed and educated in different ways. There are the traditional 2-week design courses that Dave and I have been involved in. One is coming up in the Bay Area at the Alameda Point Collaborative. That starts in October. It's a weekend course, and it's being co-taught by several amazing teachers, and two of which are actually KPFA employees, Rangita Kiesler and Babak Tandre. That's one way. We also have a series of classes at the Merritt Community College here in East Oakland that are very affordable, taught by Christopher Schein. There's a natural building class and a permaculture class. And there are also opportunities for people to do hands-on experiential learning that isn't in the form of a formal class. Coming up next Wednesday at the Alameda Point, we're going to do a hands-on volunteer day where we'll be doing things like making seed balls and using sheet mulching as a practice for building soil and plastering a cob bench.
Explain what some of the things are. Why do you make seed balls, and what is mulching? What are those things that you do?
Well, seed balls were made popular by Manasobu Fukuoka, who, by the way, his book, One Straw Revolution, where this came up, the editor and translator of that is going to be teaching at my permaculture course in 2 or 3 weeks up in the Sierras. And the idea of seed balls is that you encapsulate the seed in clay and maybe some other mineral nutrients so that the birds can't reach the seeds while they are first germinating and getting growing. And you can just throw handfuls of these seed balls out in the field, and they take care of themselves. And they can be mixed seeds if you're trying to get a mixture of things going. Some of my students have actually started businesses in the Southwest doing native plant communities in seed balls that you can just throw from your car as you go down the highway. So, yeah, and in terms of the idea about mulch, you know, mulch is important because it fosters life in the soil. Life in the soil needs moisture, it needs constant air, and it needs to not be compacted, the soil. So mulch does all those things of providing food for the funguses and bacteria that really are the source of fertility for all the other plants. So it's a way of feeding the organisms in the soil to make things happen.
And so in the Alameda Point, these seed balls, will they be cast out in the very place that they're being made? Or tell us a little bit about that.
Yes, we hope to do that. Actually, there's a 4-acre nursery planned there. So we actually hope to distribute the seed balls there and to begin that fertilization process.
And again, just to give you a little bit more information, or to actually repeat the information, the Alameda Point Collaborative, they've got this volunteer day. It's coming up this coming Wednesday, as well as a weekend of courses coming up in October. And Merritt Community College, also, if you look in their course catalog, you might be able to find out more about permaculture there.
Yes, and of course you can find a lot about permaculture at our website, which is permaculture.com. That's the International Institute for Ecological Agriculture. And we have a very exciting 2-week certification course coming up, which covers all the subjects we've been talking about. And a permaculture certification course spends the first 10 or 12 days pouring all the information into you and giving you experience with it. But then the last 3 days of the course, you design the site at which you're having the course. And this course will be at a Quaker high school in the Sierra Nevada, where we'll be designing a 200-acre site for food self-sufficiency, energy self-sufficiency, income self-sufficiency, to endow the school with biological resources that will make it permanently invulnerable to funding cuts. So this is all some of the things we'll be doing at the course, and you can learn a lot more about that at our website at permaculture.com.
I'd like also to mention that the urbanpermacultureguild.org website, I've listed a lot of courses for people to plug into, and there's lots of other information about urban permaculture there.
And I'm just curious if there's examples, you know, of how this has sort of evolved in other permaculture. Just, you know, seems more of sort of a more modern tradition, and how it compares to, you know, traditional systems, and the differences between, you know, systems that might be used in India or China or something.
Well,
are they different than let's say traditional? What's called mixed-use agriculture. There's another word I'm looking for out here. But
I can give you a really good picture of what that's like. You know, when there's two good pictures of this. There was a woman, Janet Alcorn, an ethnobotanist, who did her undergraduate work in northern Mexico and wrote a paper on 100 useful plants of the Huastec Indians. And she went back and did her master's on another 100, you know, useful plants of the Huastec Indians, going through the forest and finding all the uses for all these different things. She went back to get her PhD, and she got to 67 plants. And the people she was working with said, well, you know, there's nothing more to tell you. And, you know, and she thought, what happened? What did I do? Did I offend somebody? Why isn't someone, you know, telling me the rest of the plants in the forest? And they said, basically, because we've named them all. And this was a huge epiphany for her, because she then realized this thing that looked like a wilderness, that there were no accidental plants, that every plant in the forest over thousands of years had evolved with people and had been selected to be there. So the way that works in indigenous cultures is, you know, you're walking, let's say you're in North America and you're, an Indian in, let's say, Pennsylvania. You're walking through the forest and you see a black walnut on the ground. Well, you step on it, which is agriculture, that's planting the seed. You see a white oak and there's something shading it, and you pull the plant that's next to it because the white oak's an important source of food. So that low-level kind of management in the forest, agriculture, is agriculture. And in permaculture, we strive, you know, to try to duplicate and make more sophisticated what indigenous people have done for thousands of years, because those systems have yielded as much as 16 times the production of standard agriculture.
Yes, I'd agree. In permaculture, it was based on many indigenous people's practices, and then those practices were then blended with Western science practices. So permaculture is a blend of indigenous practices and Western science. And one of the very important pieces of permaculture is what we call thoughtful and protracted observation. And in our contemporary society, we're really focused on getting things done quickly and fast and easy. And one of the goals of permaculture is to slow down and to start small and to really reconnect with the natural cycles. And I think that indigenous cultures had that already. They knew how to do that and were continuing to do that. And we are now relearning how to relate to our landscape in that way.
Well, I'll give you a quick example from our farm that we had for 9 years on the peninsula. You know, there were a lot of squirrels there because of ecological imbalance from Stanford University's grazing lands. And these squirrels would come in the fall. And squirrels have this little switch in their head that when it flicks on, all they can think about are seeds for the winter. So they devastate your tomatoes and peppers and melons. And we observed on our farm some tomatoes that weren't getting devastated. And we noticed the reason why. We saw the squirrels hanging upside down from a gigantic sunflower head, just stuffing their face with sunflower seeds. Mm-hmm. So we said, aha. So the next year, we planted rows of sunflowers at the end of all the tomato plants so that at the time that the tomatoes were ready to harvest, so were the sunflowers ready, and the squirrels left our tomatoes alone and took care of the sunflower plants that we had left. One of the things I teach kids about permaculture is one of the basic principles put in kids' languages, if we feed our enemies and house our friends, like our friends like toads and lizards that do our work for us and bug control, we feed our enemies, like, for instance, you know, feeding our squirrel enemies here, you know, so many problems get solved. And if we would only extend that to other parts of the world, you know, and if governments would only get that, the message that if we feed our enemies and house our friends, things get very smooth.
It's funny because I've been doing a lot of traveling to the Middle East, and I'm completely struck by the fact that we're spending all this money on the military. If we actually, I don't think this is a solution, but if we actually spend that money on feeding people in Iraq and giving them jobs, as opposed to spending it on our military and sending soldiers over, we'd have much less of a problem. I think we actually need more than just Americans giving money to Iraq. I mean, Iraqis need to have their own democracy, but it would at least be a step in the right direction as opposed to bombing them.
Well, that's all the time we have for today's show, and it ends on a great note because it is truly the application of permaculture designed to other political and economic and social problems of our day. We want to make sure that we gave people a chance to find out how to contact both of you. So, Kat, if you could provide your website again and a phone number. And
phone numbers preferably also, so that people who don't have access to the web can find out.
Certainly. The web address is www.urbanpermacultureguild.org, and I can be reached at area code 510-547-7889, and I do encourage you and invite you to contact me because there's lots of resources and there's a huge community waiting for you to participate in.
And you can get a hold of our organization in Santa Cruz at www.permaculture.com. You can also get us by phone, toll-free at 888-PERMACULTURE, which is, for those of you who want to not spell it out, is 737-6228. And we've got a tremendous amount of resources in terms of books and tapes and everything you might find useful.
Again, that's urbanpermacultureguild.org and permaculture.com. Phone number for Kat, 510-547-7889. And for Dave, 888-PERMACULTURE. Permaculture. Thanks so much to Dave and Kat for being on the show and to Erica Bridgman, our engineer. The show and others are available from kpfa.org for your convenience. Have a great weekend.